I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that o-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. Today we have Brian LaRue on. We've had Brian on in the past once before to talk about begin.com, talk about the old days of PhoneGap. And today we have Brian on to talk about a couple things. First, a very strong opinion he has about not running bundlers and just raw JavaScript right to the browser, as well as enhanced.dev, which is a framework for building web apps, which is like what, standards focused. Is that the quick rundown, or give us the pitch for what it is?
Yeah, I guess the foundation of it is server rendering web components.
Yeah.
Without a build step. You can add a build step if you want to make things slower. It's fine. But
already getting spicy.
No.
Yeah. if your code's getting spicy because maybe you bundled it and you don't actually know what you're shipping, maybe you'll want an error and exception handling tracking service because maybe you're shipping some bugs. So head on over to Sentry at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word. You'll get 2 months for free, and you'll be able to track and solve your bugs way better and faster. So, yeah.
Love it. Got to do that. Can't fix bugs you can't see.
Can't fix bugs you can't see. And that is a great tagline. So I'm gonna start saying that, Brian.
Yeah, that's good. So we're both wearing our plaids today in addition to being Canadian.
This is our cultural identity, I think.
Exactly.
Right?
I can't believe that we're both wearing the red plaid today. It just feels so right.
There was a very high probability that this collision happened.
Yeah. Like how many plaids do you own? I probably own like 15. Yeah.
I've got a good battery of flannels in there that I rotate through blue, green, red, and gray. It's the time of year. It's freezing out there.
Yeah.
You need to wear warm, cozy clothes. It's kind of like a holiday thing.
You'd think they would be bigger in Denver than they are. I think we do more like furs, alpaca furs and stuff.
Really?
Like, we got alpaca farms everywhere. I don't personally, but I'm saying that's what you see. That and Patagonia. We just got Patagonia, but you don't see flannels everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a real Canadian thing for sure. Like this is definitely a part of our
heritage
vibe. Yeah, this Arc'teryx, Blundstones. You're ready to walk around in any Canadian city.
The Canadian starter pack.
Yes.
So let's talk about opinion on not using a bundler. So Brian is a really good follow on Twitter. He's always spitting hot takes, but not obnoxious ones. There's a lot of people that spend all day on hot takes on Twitter, and I find it to be obnoxious. I feel like Brian has a really good even head towards his opinions on Twitter. I'm always interested in like, what does that, you'll see me reply. What does that mean? Tell me more. And one of your things you've been talking about lately is that you don't use a bundler. You don't TypeScript it. You don't babble it. You don't run it through Vite. You just load JavaScript in the browser like some kind of psycho. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I'm not anti anything, to just be clear. I'm pro start with the simplest thing that could possibly work. And I feel we reach for a lot of tools without actually measuring or thinking about how we're going to use those tools or what benefits they might provide. And so, you know, bundling is a technique. It's not an edict. And browsers are designed to execute JavaScript, and they're pretty good at it. And in the past few years, they've gotten even better at it, especially networking. We've got, you know, HTTP 2, HTTP 3. We can download things in parallel. We've got pretty good CDNs. They already broadly in gzip stuff for you. And so I'm not saying don't bundle. I am saying you should measure. And you can't fix what you can't measure. And so you should use a tool like Sentry to look at what like you're building and understand what you're building and make that thing better. And yeah, start with the simplest thing that can work. And the simplest thing that could work is probably HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And, you know, if that isn't cutting it, then absolutely start, you know, doing what it takes to make things better. We started asking in advance, like, how far can we go here and what can we build? And, you know, we heard a lot of people say, well, there's certain types of apps that, you know, you can't build unless you use a bundler. And we actually haven't found that edge yet. And, you know, we put our work out there for people to see. So it's all open source, and you can, you know, go to enhance.dev/showcase, and you can open up Chrome DevTools and you can trace stuff for yourself and see, look at the source code, view source even works. And so, like, there are downsides to bundlers, and this is, you know, not my, I don't have like a hate or something. Like, people are like, you hate bundlers. I'm like, no, we use ESBuild ourselves at times when we have like really chunky dependencies, but we'll bundle those. We won't bundle everything. So one downside is you got to wait. You know, it's a developer experience hit. Your iteration speed will always be faster without a bundle step. You know, you can improve that bundle step by 1,000%. It's still slower than by 100% than no bundle step. So avoiding a bundle step is just better developer velocity to start. Now, the other cost, and the bigger cost to me anyways, is the debug loop is harder. And you can band-aid that. So if you bundle everything, you've got one single file that's one column, and you get a bug at runtime. Chances are Sentry is going to help you figure out where that was, but chances aren't guaranteed that it will. Now, we can use things like source maps to make that better and get like a real stack trace where we've got a line number and we know what to go fix. But odds are you're going to chuck some darts with console.log before you figure that out. And that's slower developer speed. So you again are hitting your iteration speed. And maintenance doesn't happen at a convenient time. You're going to be out picking up your kids or, you know, going over to your parents' house and have no computer or... Yeah. Like, it's always at the worst possible time, and then your error is going to be on, like, line 1, column 10,000, undefined as not a function. You know, good luck with that, buddy. And you're on the hook. And so a real stack trace is actually quite nice when you're debugging an application. The other last thing to say about the no debug is it's contextual. So I feel browsers, as we put more and more work on them, it definitely is a great tool to have in your box, and it's a useful one. On the server, there's really no evidence that this is a good thing. So we recently created a new project called AWS Lite. It replaces the AWS SDK. You can find it at awslite.org. And we didn't want to do this at all. this was really a thing that we kind of had to do. So Amazon did the JavaScript thing, and they created a new SDK, and they based it on TypeScript, and they transpiled it, and it supports Dino, Node, and browsers. It supports CommonJS, ESM for all of those payloads. And they ship it in a single package to NPM. And the resulting payload is something like 95 megabytes, which is a huge kick in Lambda's nuts for a cold start. And worse, they're forcing that as an upgrade path in Node 20. You can't use the V2 SDK anymore. And so we're facing like a pretty big performance regression. And they were like, well, don't worry, you can just bundle it. And we're like, oh man, that is not a great answer, because now we can't debug it. And Node errors are even harder to debug than browser errors, because we don't have a dev tools for Node. You know, at best, we're going to have like a third-party analytics or error reporting service. So you really want good line numbers in your Node process, and that's a different place. In AWS Lite, we have this extensive set of benchmarks, and we show that we're about 5 times faster. But the really most fascinating part about those benchmarks, you can go see and reproduce this for yourself. So this isn't, you know, don't shoot the messenger here. I'm just sharing data. This is science. Hopefully we can all agree that that's a good idea. Bundling slower than not bundling in this case. Now, this is this case. This isn't all cases. So you'll hear people say, well, bundling's faster. And that's just not true. Like, there's different cases, and not all bytes are the same. If you have a whole bunch of modules and you bundle them, certainly you have less imports. But it depends on what's in those modules. If you're loading a bunch of dead code, or you have a whole bunch of binary data in there, it could actually be slower. And in the case of the AWS SDK, it is. So, or in our AWS Lite package, it is slower. So it always comes back to measure and observe and improve based on data. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're all about. And when I'm saying, you know, don't bundle, I'm not saying don't ever bundle. I'm saying don't start with a bundler. Maybe grow into that need and prove you need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of my long-term dreams is to be able to push the code I write to NPM as a package. You know, like, wouldn't that be nice?
Right.
Because it's such a pain in the butt to try figure out why a library is broken. Because you go on GitHub and that might not be the same thing that's on NPM. And then you look into NPM, you're like, which one of these 11 outputs am I using? Then finally you open it and it's all like variables are called A and H. And I just, it's so frustrating. And I just wish that there was, I just want to import the code that was authored and run it. And obviously things make that impossible to do. Well, not impossible, but much trickier. So people are probably wondering right now, like, but what about X, Y, and Z? So we've got a couple of what abouts here. And the first one is, what about TypeScript? Don't you use TypeScript?
Yes, I love TypeScript. We do use it. We use it with JS doc and D.TS files that we import. So nice. We even write TypeScript and then we just import those as JS doc comments. And is it perfect? No. And is it as good as using raw TypeScript with all the tooling out there in the full ecosystem? Totally isn't. But it gets us types, gets us that, you know, red squigglies and the auto completes.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really here for. So yeah, we use TypeScript. We like it. We use it with JS doc, which, you know, sometimes people look at me like I'm a lizard when I say that, but it works great. And it's nice because there's no build step and it doesn't obfuscate my code.
No, I was going to say, and there's a low key, sometimes there's like things that are easier with the JS doc style typing. Like you can type an entire function with an import rather than having to type
descriptions,
the result of the function and the, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like things have gotten a little, I don't want to like make people feel bad, but like sometimes it feels like the type thing has gotten a little, out of hand, really generic, not very specific. The guidance of the types is actually getting lost now in that they're becoming almost too generic, too fancy. It's like, yeah, okay, we got type guards here, but I don't know what this T value is. Like this is a meaningless value to me. Like
when we hover over top of some of our Prisma TypeScript errors, it's like 1,000 lines. And some libraries are starting to go less in the generic area and more in the generated area because it's just like, I can't read this error.
I mean, I want to know if something's a string or a number, and I want to know, you know, what the name of that variable is and what weird way Amazon decided to spell it this time.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, it's pretty diminishing returns for me personally. So, I like the lighter touch typing. Like, I don't think it has to go so deep. It should be a convenience. And it should be somewhat self-documenting. So that's another nice thing about the JS doc. It comes in line and feels like, you know, now it's reading like what's going on. I don't have, and I know this is why people want to put it in one file because then, you know, then it's all there. And that totally makes sense at author time, but it stops making sense at runtime for me.
We'll talk about the JavaScript file. So one thing about shipping ESM straight to the browser is that you could have an entry point and that could have, it parses that and then you could have import inside of that. And then it parses that and that could be imported inside of that. And you get a waterfall. So people are saying, yeah, HTTP 2, HTTP 3 fixes that. But then some people say, no, it doesn't fix that.
It doesn't.
How do you,
no.
Is that just something you live with? Is there's a potential waterfall of imports?
Yeah. So, you know, you're writing the code. You can not do that. Right, like you're allowed.
When
there's a good part here, and the good part, I mean, honestly, a lot of the time we end up inlining the JavaScript, which sounds even crazier, I'm sure. So we'll inline it in the HTML document at the end of the page because there's so little of it when you're doing progressive enhancement. Mm-hmm. We're talking tens of kilobytes, not megabytes. So when it's that small, and you can view source on Enhanced Dev and take a look at how we do that. It's literally script tags at the bottom of the page. And it loads sub-second. Now, if it was huge and it was big and we wanted to split it up a little and get smarter about sharing code between different pages, yeah, bring a bundle to the party. That's what those are designed for. But we don't have that problem to start with. So I'm not saying that problem doesn't exist. I'm just saying we can sidestep that by being sort of intentional about how we write our code.
And because like a lot of these frameworks are starting to say default everything to the server, the amount of JavaScript you need on the client is like, I just went to enhanced-music.com, which is one of your things, and opened up the dev tools, clicked filter for JS, and it is 21 lines, including the service worker registration. Mm-hmm. So like it's not a lot of JavaScript. So does server rendering a lot of this just sidestep a lot of these waterfall concerns?
Yeah. And well, and again, how you structure your modules and your components. In the transpiler world, we start with JavaScript. You know, you write, well, you don't really, you write JSX or you write, you know, .svelte or .astro or whatever, but effectively you're writing what becomes JavaScript files. And then you execute those JavaScript files to generate HTML. In our world, you're writing either straight up HTML, which I know sounds totally nuts, or you're writing a JavaScript function that returns HTML and runs inside of Node. And so the only thing that hits the browser ever is HTML. And then, you know, some small pithy amount of client JavaScript for registering events and handling them. And it is a totally, it's pushing all the JavaScript into the Node runtime, basically.
I'm curious about how you still manage to do things like for instance, on this enhanced music page, right? You're able to have a player that sticks around amongst page navigation. And that's like typically thought of as like a spa feature. Well,
yeah.
How do you get around that those limitations?
It's an iframe.
It's an iframe.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Using the platform. Yeah.
Iframe in a web component of all things. It's
wow. Oh my gosh, that's like the most old and the most new tech converging.
Yeah, we had a snarky person say, "Well, you couldn't build like a Spotify with like web components." And we were like, "Yeah, I don't know, maybe." And then we were like, "Oh, yeah, well, sure we can. No problem." It misses on some aspects, I think, of the user interaction. If I was to redo this one, I'd probably actually just make it a single page, but not a single page app, but like actually just a single page where you got a long playlist and you just hit play, it would reload the page and reload the audio element with that player and Bob's your uncle. Because you don't really want to pause and navigate music at the same time. I don't do that anyways. So I don't know. It was a fun experiment though. And we were like, does this... iframe's been around a while. It should be should work on mobile, and it turns out it does. So yeah, it's a weirdly valid technique now. I think it got vilified back in the table layout days, and sort of left that one hanging. But it's pretty stable now. The only issue I have with iframes might be around reading and writing client cookies is a bit funky, but there are ways around that too. So you know, there's always a hack with browsers.
And what about like live reloading and dev tooling? Like you make a change, you want to see it updated in the browser. Do you still get that type of tooling when you go this way?
Yeah. Well, in Enhance, we kick a WebSocket and we watch your file system and we will force a reload of the client JavaScript if you've enabled that. And this is another great thing about the way that we're approaching things. The dev tools work. So you don't need a plugin or something like the real dev, like the view sourcey inspect element dev tools. They all work and they're great. Like the only thing I find still really awkward right now with Chrome dev tools, slotting with web components, the way they show it in the dev tool is kind of weird. They like render these sub documents that you kind of got to dig into to find things. It's hard to describe. It's almost like they tagged them and then they put them in a different place in the DOM than they really are. But that's the only thing that I found kind of awkward. Otherwise, browsers are really good now, man. Like really, really good. Like we are so spoiled. The way it used to be was pretty rough compared to today. And like And it's hilarious because our ecosystems have basically niched us out of using the native tooling that's available to the platform that has been improving this whole time. So I feel there's a lot of merit to getting back to some of these sort of really basic things and looking at like how the platform works and using the tools that are bundled with your browser. Even WebKit's tooling is actually pretty great, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, there are times when it gets annoying in the WebKit land, but I mean, they're shipping.
And, you should see it. Last night, WebKit announced their like 17 release, and like I could hardly scroll to the bottom of that blog post. It was unbelievable.
And Nicole Sullivan. Yeah,
they just hired Nicole Sullivan. So yeah.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. And she's like manager of layouts or something like that. Like the
Apple hired someone
just to focus on layouts rendering in the browser.
Wow.
Yeah, it's good news for the web. I love seeing that. It's awesome. Yeah, WebKit's, it gets a rough rap these days, but I think they've been giving it a college try for sure. It's been improving. And the baseline, like our expectations now are pretty awesome. Like we're, when are they going to finally have view transitions between or multi-page transitions API? Like we're asking for some pretty heavy duty stuff.
Like
the browser's pretty good these days.
Yeah, remember we were stoked about rounded corners? Like, spoiled.
Box shadow, yeah, stoked about that.
Yeah,
box
shadow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah, I love just getting in there and kind of working close to the platform. But, it isn't without its quirks and annoyances. We try and paper over that stuff inside of Enhance as much as we can. But we're also trying to, like, see what can we do with this platform that we compile to mostly. And there's kind of a fallacy that we need the compiler. Like, I read this the other day in Twitter. Someone's like, it was really bundlers that moved the state of the art forward. And like what? You can only bundle to what the browser can do. Like the bundler didn't bring anything new to the story. It just let us write more JavaScript and get away with it. It really doesn't change the baseline capability available to us. So
what about I think Babel was such a major step forward because finally we're able to write our JavaScript in such a better way. And it, like, I know you didn't use any of the ES6 stuff until it was in the browser. Is that true? I think I remember that. Just wait.
I was on board with the transpiling thing at the beginning. I just wait now.
Do you not have ADHD? I can't wait for shit.
You don't want CSS nesting?
I definitely do. But so browsers didn't used to be evergreen. And I don't think they all were until roughly 2018. I could be wrong about that. So there was a necessity for a Babel. Like we needed a Babel if we wanted to use the latest stuff. There was no upgrading your browser. But now I visit my parents, at the holidays like everyone else, and I don't have to upgrade any browsers. It's been done for me. And like that is a huge boon for web developers. So we could kind of depend now on a baseline capability. And I'm not the best developer in the world. I don't need the most bleeding edge features. Like I'm, hiding divs and showing them like everybody else. And that stuff doesn't really need a lot of heavyweight tooling at all. So
the browser upgrade path is so much faster these days. Like, so last night I was tweeting about how awesome WebKit is and people are like, oh, it's awful. Like it's the new IE still. And
no.
Like people are like older versions of Safari. And I went and looked at the stats and I was like, iOS 17 came out 2.5 months ago and it almost has a bigger market share than iOS 16, meaning the hardest browser to upgrade because you have to reboot your computer and like
install
reboot your phone
update
in the middle of the night and like put in your code. That's like the hardest browser to update. And they already in 2.5 months have almost eclipsed the previous version of the browser. I think that's pretty amazing.
It's a way better situation than we used to be in. I remember being like kind of suspicious of this too. I was like, I don't know. Should those browsers update? Like could do something bad, but no, that was the absolute right thing to happen. I think the important thing to remember now is that we'd still need browser diversity and choice. if we have a singular engine that's auto-updating from a company that's effectively an ad network, that might not be a great idea. But that's that. Like Safari is important. WebKit is really important because as Firefox wanes, we do need that competition to keep everybody honest and keep privacy and the open web at the forefront. It's a one-way door, too. Like, we don't want that door to close. We saw what happened with IE. It was a bad scene.
Bad scene. Yeah. We just had Eric Meyer on, and we were asking him about his idea about the futures of Firefox. And he also, you know, lamented that it doesn't feel like it's going in a great direction right now in terms of longevity. So we need WebKit out there.
I'll say this, though. Firefox has always been, like, on the doorstep of death. Like, it always, like, there's never been a moment where it's been like, oh man, everyone's using Firefox. Like, it's always been this weird sort of outlier, and yet they seem to survive. So I don't know how they keep pulling that. Like, they're like a cat. They have like nine lives,
but
they keep coming back.
I'm just waiting for them to pull out their AI model that's fair or something like that, like just like a Hail Mary, you know. I hope so. I'm a longtime Firefox user. I know we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but I really, really hope they pull through.
I keep a Firefox open. I have this is the, like, I run all three because you know, there's, and even though we have auto upgrading, we have great standards, there's still always some feature that's weird on one of these browsers. It, like, you can't even predict, you have to test it. So
I tend to switch my main driver like once every couple of like 2 months, especially now that with like 1Password or whatever, I can bop around pretty easily, but just to get a vibe, see what's working where. Let's take some time to talk about Enhance at enhance.dev, the HTML first full stack web framework. You have a really great little landing page here. I know we've already kind of touched on this a bit. Where do we want to start here? Do we want to talk high level? Because I feel like we've already done that a little bit, or do we want to start diving into some of these things?
Yeah, I think let's talk about what it is a little bit more. So is enhance.dev a meta framework, meaning that you can build a full stack application, client side, server side, run database queries with that?
I think it counts. The meta framework terminology is a bit weird because it, you know, we had client side frameworks and then they decided to go full stack. I use that loosely. I'm scare quoting right now. And so I guess a meta framework would be something that's like kind of like client side capable, but also could do some back endy stuff. And Enhance actually went the other way. So it started its life as another project called Architect. And under the hood, it actually is Architect. It's a plugin to Architect. Architect is a serverless framework for building apps using Lambda, API Gateway, and DynamoDB. And people would ask us, how do you do the front end for Architect? And we'd be like, however you want. And they'd be like, no, seriously, man, how do you do it? We'd be like, well, I would return HTML and progressively enhance it. And they'd look at me like I was a lizard. So I would eventually, we kind of had to have an answer. And that answer for us became enhance. We didn't really want to go down the road of being yet another React framework or yet another kind of meta framework that was focused on transpiling. We felt there was a need for somebody to be like, hey, why don't we do this with web standards?
Yeah.
You know, why don't we try web components? Like, maybe they're okay now. And in our view, they are.
So this could be seen as the meta framework for the web platform, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And I think a big component of that is the, as you've mentioned, web components and SSRing of web components. It seems like something that a lot of people are either, I don't want to say ignoring, maybe not putting up to a huge amount of importance. What are you guys doing to SSR web components, and why did you feel like that was an important step to take?
Yeah, so initial work in HTML is just always going to be faster. That's how browsers work. Script tags load JavaScript. And so the more work you can do on that server before you send it down to the client, the better. Web components have kind of been mostly a client-side concern, and the web component upgrade is largely a client-side thing. But Christopher Joseph on our team realized a couple of years ago now, actually, that you could expand the web component template independent of the behavior. And so he wrote a little mini interpreter. And so Enhanced literally takes web component definitions and expands them on the server and then returns the resulting HTML. And most of that HTML is in the light DOM by default. And I know what you're thinking right now. You're probably thinking it's an interpreter. Oh my God, it's probably pretty slow. We put server timing headers in recently, and we're rendering something like 10,000 components in sub 10 milliseconds. So wow. it's plenty fast. it doesn't really need a build step to do that. You could shave 10 milliseconds if you needed to, but you probably don't. And we still can do caching headers and stuff if we want to like have, you know, a static result returned to the client. So yeah, it's a little mini interpreter that opens up web components and then pre-renders them. And then your client-side code ends up just listening to events and responding to them, and then occasionally maybe doing some DOM manipulation, but in a lot of cases doesn't need to. And so like the kind of like key example I like to give, when you're building out an application, you've got a big header. Chances are that's full of a bunch of anchor tags. None of that really needs to listen to JavaScript anymore. You can do all that with just plain old HTML and maybe some CSS for hiding and showing business. And that's a beauty case for a server-rendered web component. There's no listening on the client needed at all. And then the other thing is your header is not really something someone's going to reuse on somebody else's website. It's going to have your brand and your logo mark and all that. So you don't really need a shadow DOM or any of that isolation. Like it's your website. So you know, it's specific to your design system and your application. So it's a nice default, and you can still drop into the client and do whatever you want. I actually was just helping someone wrap some React components in web components the other day to see if we could strangle them out. And it turns out we can. And so like there's a migration path here too for people that want to kind of go more low level or eke more performance out.
Yeah, that header example is very interesting because I'm working on some show notes for our episode on React server components. And one of the examples I'm trying to go through is like a header, right? Like a header should be server rendered. However, there might be parts of it that need to be dynamic, like a little notification bell that checks if you have any updates or something like that. That can be done in the client. But the one question I don't have the answer to is, what about just like underlining the current page, right? You want to show like an active or an active parent. Do you have to re-render the header on every single page then?
Mm. Yeah, we do.
Okay.
Yeah. We allow for you to take over at the client level and do things like change, you know, which parent is currently highlighted. You get past the request when you render, and so you know the path, and so you can check against that to do the, you know, the underline or the highlight or whatever. But yeah, as you click around, the default experience would be fully server rendered for every request. And yeah, there's a penalty to that. You know, some of those requests you might want to embed a single page app, but that's kind of the nice thing about starting this way is that you have that flexibility. Like there's really a single page app is a one-way trip. You can't really come out of that and turn it into this multi-page experience, but you can always embed a rich application instead of a multi-page experience.
Okay. And if I had like a chat window inside my application that needed to update whenever there was new chats or something that like a part of the website that needed to be dynamic, is there something in Enhanced that would let me say ping the backend and refresh just that part of the application, or is that a full page reload?
No, yeah, we support there's a better way. We support WebSockets, and because you've got all of AWS at your fingertips, you can use things like SNS or SQS for asynchronous events. So you could listen to the database, DynamoDB. Mm-hmm. You could stream the response of a read or a write to that database to a WebSocket, and it could push the update into the client. The client doesn't even need to poll for it. Mm. And that could be an upgrade. That doesn't even have to be like the default experience, server render it. The client JavaScript kicks in, opens a WebSocket connection, and your progressive enhancement is listening for these events to upgrade the experience.
And I theoretically also could push HTML over that WebSocket as well.
Yeah, man. HTMX style.
All right.
These days. I'm into it. I'm feeling it. Like, it's weird, but it's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, because like if you have a pretty heavy dependency or a dependency that can't run in the client but is needed to render that chat window, it might make sense to just render that part on. And like there's big in the Ruby world, big in the PHP world. So it's kind of interesting. We're starting to see it now in JavaScript world.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of it. And yeah, HTML over the wire is the same thing as JSON over the wire. It's just text. So, yeah. You know, and inner HTML works great with text. And it feels strange.
Yeah.
It feels like you're doing something you're not supposed to do, but it works perfectly fine and is absolutely a valid technique.
Yeah. The jQuery load function, I'm pretty sure if I remember correctly, the second argument to the jQuery load function was a selector, meaning that you could load an entire HTML page and then it would return to you a subset of the DOM. Say, all right, let me select just this piece.
Mm. Yeah, why not? You know, and like, I think... You know, whatever it is, it gets the job done, is valid. Mm-hmm. All these tools are available to us, and we can kind of count on the browsers being fairly good these days. So it's neat watching the HTMX thing take. Their whole thing is like turning formerly inert DOM elements into suddenly interactive DOM elements, but you do it all declaratively, which I really, really love. And I think there's more to be explored here around declarative marking up attributes or using things like web components to add enhancements when the behavior is available.
Yeah, it's an interesting world. What about like state management? I know that is like one of the biggest topics in React land.
Ooh. Yeah, this one comes up a lot. So we tried to not have an opinion. And then we realized that's like basically telling people to go F themselves. So we're just forming opinions now. So you can use a MobX or an X state or whatever if you want on the client. That's fine. Our approach generally is get the thing working first with just HTML. And then, you know, intercept that on submit on the form and start doing your JavaScript magic as a second step. Because it's going to be way easier than trying to decrypt how a state machine client side works to a back end. You'll end up with just a thing that only works with JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And you'll end up with something that honestly a lot more complicated. So it seems more complicated to get the back end working without client JavaScript at first. But it actually turns out that most cases you won't need state management at all. We have a pattern on our blog where we get into how we would theoretically show you how you could do it using a service worker. And, you know, it's pretty involved. We got to take it off the main thread because we don't want to involve awaits blocking the UI. So we put it in a worker, but we essentially listen for events and then we use a thing called morph DOM to update the DOM based on stuff coming back. But we will only do this after we get the form working first. And for a lot of forms, it doesn't matter. You know, like if your form submits and it reloads the page, you're just happy you got that person's email. Like you don't care. Like, and that person, I guarantee you, doesn't care. So, and browsers are pretty fast. Network's pretty fast. A lot of cases we're talking sub-second responses. We're not talking 3-4 second wait times here. So most of the time you don't need these tools. And I would say try and build without them and reach for them only when things get so complex that you have to have like a state machine on the client. Mm-hmm. We're working on some better examples that sort of show what I'm talking about with WebSockets, because we think that's probably the end game here. Usually you're submitting some value to some either API or database, and then you want to respond to the client with some result of that. And that result might be errors. It might be problems that they need to fix a form. You spelled your name wrong, or you used a character you can't use, or you used a username that's not available because it's only available in the database. That's a call that only the backend can make. Mm-hmm. And so in these cases, you may want to reach for, you know, a slightly more complicated thing, but you really do want to get that back end working with the client first without any JavaScript if you can on the client.
And is there any special sauce around form submissions? So we built our recent website in Svelte, and we love the form actions. And I see React is starting to add that too. You just, how do you do a form then? Do you just create like, and one thing we didn't mention is you have file system based routing, right? So you just make a folder and you put a file in it and that's your route.
Yep.
So you just make an API route?
Yeah, we have a concept of API routes. They follow the same symmetry as the page routes. And you can just put like a form in your page and then you'll have like an API route at whatever path that you want. And then you would export a function that named post to respond to a post. And Bob's your uncle. That will either return a redirect or JSON, depending on if it was called with XHR or fetch. XHR being our good old friend XML HTTP request, which nobody uses anymore, but I still say sometimes and people look at me like I'm weird. So if you use an XHR or a fetch, we'll return a JSON payload. But if you submit that form, just like regular HTML submit, it'll do a redirect instead. And the page will re-render with the state that it needs and you don't need to do any rejigging. Mm-hmm. That's kind of built in. But there's some work for you to do there. We have a thing we call the problems loop. So there's some like requirements for a good form. A good form is going to give people good feedback. It's going to give them good errors. It's ideally going to give them good errors before they submit that form. So there's some client-side JavaScript involved. When you do submit that form, you better not lose the values that I entered that were good, especially if it's a long form. So if I have to like fill out my address a second time, you're going to lose me as a customer. And if you want this form to be bulletproof, you want it to work without JavaScript enabled. And so in order to achieve all of these things, you have to use a session. And this can get a little tricky. There's a bit of like hard to parse ideas going on here. So when I submit the form, I want to do the validation on the back end. I have to do it on the back end, as I can't validate on the client and not have back end validation, or else someone could, you know, break our security. And when that validation finishes occurring, if there's a problem, I want to return those in a session because we're going to redirect if that form was submitted without JavaScript, and I want those values to be populated. Tools like Rails build this in, and Enhance, we have a set of components that build this in. So this pattern is just there for you to have. And then at any time, you can intercept that on submit and redo it yourself on the client. I find once you've built out a few of these bulletproof forms, you'll get to that client step and you'll be like, well, I don't really want to rebuild the whole thing. I just want to like say, for example, do that username check before they submit, or maybe a password strength thing. You don't want to submit a form if the password's like, you know, one character. Mm-hmm. And those are great use cases for progressive enhancement on the client. And you'll have a form that's probably sub 5 kilobytes of client JavaScript, which pretty good experience.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Does Enhance do anything for CSS, or does it just say, hey, you author your CSS as CSS and we use web components for scoping? Is that the vibe?
So we've got opinions. One of our opinions is utility CSS is pretty good. And we think if you're going to try and have if you want to avoid the ever-growing styles.css file, then you want to use something like utility CSS. Utility CSS will fall apart. Like there are specific components specific to your infrastructure or your application that are going to need specific styles. And in those cases, we'd recommend just embedding a style tag in the component and raw dog that CSS, and it'll be scoped to that component. And then we have a utility system. People get really divided about this. So you can bring SAS, you can bring Tailwind, you can write just raw CSS.
Yeah.
But we really, really, really think there are advantages to using a utility system and learning it. Our utility system's inspired by more tachyons than Tailwind. Okay. And we do a fluid type style. So it's responsive, which is to say you don't need a bunch of breakpoints. It will scale up and down to mobile and desktop interfaces without having to rely too much on breakpoints. You'll still need breakpoints for some stuff, like when to hide and show that sidebar menu, for example. But like for the text in the page and most of the components in the page, I mean, Flex and Grid are really, really good now. And
so good, yeah.
Fluid scales and CSS variables, I mean, come on, we are spoiled. We found we don't need a lot of extra stuff there. We bake in our sort of opinions, and you can use them if you want to, but we absolutely recognize that people have their own opinions. So they awesome. Want to do their own thing, and yeah, you can do whatever, basically. But we want to get better at explaining this fluid stuff, as I feel it's actually pretty important, but people aren't quite there yet.
Yeah, I'm just rolling through all of your CSS file on begin.com, and you can kind of get an idea how it all works. Looks good.
This does actually get back to measuring, though, and just to, not to like belabor it, but I think the ever-growing CSS problem still does even exist a little bit mm-hmm. in utility world, where we've got build steps, and it can be solved. You can have a file that doesn't get any bigger and support light mode and dark mode and multiple device sizes, and fluid scales is the path. But it's another system, and it's a new thing to learn. So it's, there's trade-offs.
Yeah.
But it's worth measuring and looking at. And if you're finding that your design system's getting unruly, I think all paths point to components and fluid scale.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two things for us before our CSS will finally get into the happy land is the contrast color function and the relative color syntax. You give me those two things and holy cow, our CSS files will get way smaller.
So much.
It's coming.
A couple of problems right now, and yeah, it will solve all of those.
Yeah, I love that.
Whoa, I'm going to take a deeper look at your CSS now.
The layout stuff is so good these days. One trick that we're still trying to figure out is, do we want layout components? Like, mm-hmm. remember back in the Flash days, you had like VBox and HBox and stuff. Like, you know, with Grid, you can get that kind of feeling, but there is a bit of a barrier to entry there. And so we've been toying with the idea, should there be layout components?
Like, yeah.
That did work well in Flex and is kind of a cool idea.
We kind of do that. On syntax, on the new syntax site, we went hard on Grid for everything. So even vertically, nice. The site's laid out with Grid. And name zones, gutters and columns and everything for just about everything within they're just class-based components. So it's just a class name, but you could say that it is still a layout component.
Totally. Yeah, I think it's great. Like we're in a weird spot right now where the state of the art of the browser has actually exceeded the state of the art of the practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're still learning what are all these new tools meaning? And like, yeah, they're coming fast and hard. Like WebKit is dropping new stuff every week, it feels like, finally. And yeah, there's all sorts of cool stuff in Chrome. Like view transitions are barely explored and offer, I think, like a lot of functionality that we used to think was reserved for native apps.
Yeah. Excited about that. That and scroll driven animations going to be pretty. We're going to. Somebody on Twitter today was saying how they're so happy that the parallax websites are dead. And I was like, buckle up. We're going to have another run of that.
Yeah. Right after skeuomorphism comes back fully, moment will also get. Yeah. Parallax is coming
back. I'm here for it.
Yep.
Retro skeuomorphism. It's weird. It does look retro though. See it now, and it's like, oh wow, there was like stitching in that leather of the iCal.
Oh yeah.
I want to ask you quickly about AWS reInvent. So that is Amazon's massive conference. You went there. How was it? Why were you there?
I've been going for a long time, and I go now as an AWS serverless hero, which is their sort of developer community, embarrassing name for it, but awesome. They spoil us and it's great. We kind of get sort of priority seating at all the keynotes and can elbow our way into all the good parties, but it's overwhelming. So there's between 60 and 70,000 people there. They book out the Venetian, the MGM, the Bellagio, I think two or three other hotels, but I can't remember which ones. I kind of don't leave the Venetian. Oh, the Wynn. That's the other one. And there are hundreds and hundreds of sessions a day. There are dozens and dozens of parties every night. It is almost overwhelming. So for me, I'm kind of in the serverless-y back-endy niche of Amazon. Amazon's huge. There's 400 services, and it spans everything from, you know, databases to machine learning to servers to whatever. So the serverless world and the infrastructure as code world is kind of the, where my interests lie. And yeah, I try and catch two or three sessions a day. I did a couple talks and otherwise hung out with cool people and watched the keynotes. Saw Chris Williams there, which was awesome. I hadn't seen him in years, the old curator of JSConf.
Yeah.
He's doing good. It was just a lot of fun. Didn't catch COVID, unbelievably, with all those people. So get vaccinated and wear masks. It works. And it was very Gen AI themed, which is a bit eye-rolling, but also where we're at right now as an industry. There's clearly a sea change happening. There's a lot of undiscovered country there. And Amazon wants to own all the, you know, wheelbarrows and pickaxes for this new gold rush. And so their thing's called Bedrock. It's kind of a sprawling service for managing large language models. And I'm going to add support in the form of a plugin to actually architect, begin, and enhance soon. It's pretty neat. You can pick from different open source models out there, like Claude from Anthropic or Amazon's Titan. And it does all the gross stuff. So it hosts the model and you can send it prompts and you can get the responses back to a Lambda function. You don't have to deal with clusters or keeping a server up or managing the models or the model versions. These things are coming so fast. So there's like a new model every month and you want to change and swap them out and compare them. And you definitely don't want to build that infrastructure. And so for them, it's like, you know, you change one line of code, you get a different model under the hood. You can train it with your own knowledge base. You can have it access your own databases with vector databases. So it can do what are called RAGs, which is retrieval of information. So you can make it smart and customize the agent for your own use. But these things are so early and they're so unpredictable right now that it's got to be taken with a big spoon of salt. Like people are really excited and venture capitalists will basically fund anyone that can spell AI right now. And it's not
that's a funny joke.
I wish it was mine. It wasn't mine. I stole that from Austin Collins from Serverless Framework, but to give attribution, but it's a little heady. So like I'm there for the serverless stuff and it's almost now boring technology. It used to be the racy thing, you know. It used to be, oh, serverless, you guys are nuts. Now everyone's like, yeah, serverless.
Yeah,
that's what we do. So yeah, it was cool. It's big. I recommend every developer check it out at least once. There's nothing else like it. And it's so weird because JavaScript in that world is kind of a redheaded stepchild. It's not the thing. Most of the developers there are probably writing Python or Java.
Wow. And the scale of AWS is always amazes me. I remember when we were trying to do the transcriptions for this podcast, and that was the first time I had seen the new version 3 of the API. And I was like, this thing is absolutely massive. There's so many, like the fact that they were able to get all the teams together and build this amazing TypeScript API, like that's, we understand it's 95 megs, but it's unbelievable. All the little niches that AWS has.
They are unlike any other org. So they don't coordinate. That's their secret. And so like that SDK is a small team, a two pizza team. It really is. So every little service is a small team and they can only communicate with each other via APIs. And that's why we see so many different takes on APIs with different kind of flavors of payload. And the result of that is a lack of consistency and the confusing developer experience. But the benefit of that is they get this huge amount of scale and velocity.
Yeah.
They move as fast as a startup, but they are massive.
Wow.
That facilitates startups like ours where we can create like kind of a sanity layer on top and make things a little more sensible and easier to digest. And I think I checked for us, we use something like 30 services total. So like less than 10% of all of AWS. And yeah, there's something for everyone there. And a lot of it isn't for me. And that's okay. And that's okay. Like, you know, they've got, traditional databases like Postgres and RDS and Aurora. And like, I'm all in on DynamoDB these days and I like it a lot. And like, it's fine. Like, you know, some people don't like that and I get it. That's cool. Don't use it. So they're just trying to capture everyone.
And that's what Begin CLI is, right? Like last time you were on here, Begin was a way to interface and host your applications. Is it still that or has it sort of changed?
No, it's still that. Yeah, still doing its thing, still stable. Build serverless apps. We originally were kind of more architect focused. These days we're, you know, using Enhance as your way of getting a site online. But yeah, within a minute and a half, you can have a URL. Within another five, you can have your own domain. And that's all running on our Amazon. And if you upgrade to our pro tier, you can run it on your own Amazon account, which is kind of unique. I think the only other people doing that would be like Flight Control, FlyBear's thing. He's got the same vibe. I think at the enterprise level, that's what they want. You'll see bigger companies like HashiCorp who do Terraform. You know, they don't host anything. People host their own Amazon, but they use Terraform to deploy to Amazon and keep it under control.
Awesome. Any thoughts on last time Dino was early days and now Dino is much more stable? We've got Bun, several other frameworks. Any thoughts on all these new JavaScript runtimes?
I feel like they really validated Node, which I actually wasn't expecting. Node was feeling stagnant.
Yeah.
And it lit a bit of a fire under Node to get unstagnant. And in the meantime, they're all chasing Node compatibility.
Yeah.
So they kind of just ratified Node as the standard, which is great. I still hack around on Dino. I didn't like Bun personally a lot. It didn't work on Amazon Linux and they were not super receptive to that idea. Mm. So I was like, yeah, whatever. That's where I run my workloads. So not for me. And that's okay. I actually have been falling back in love with Node lately because of all these things.
Yeah.
they sort of made it better. Like Node's built-in test runner.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Yeah. Test runner.
And like
.env support. Like, all the little things.
We just had Yagitz on. He is working on config files for Node, so you don't have a million flags in your package JSON.
Yeah.
So yeah, and he said they are very close to having TypeScript support via a loader as well, which is pretty nifty.
We're goofing around with those loaders, doing some weird stuff with import maps, loading some things client, some things server, sharing validation logic. And it's promising.
Yeah. No.
The ESM thing was a real speed bump.
Yeah.
But I feel like we've got the tire back on the car and it's driving down the road now. And like, there was a minute there where it was like, oh my God, this is so painful. But
yeah,
they've really turned a corner.
Cool. Was there anything that we missed, Brian, that you wanted to cover?
No, I mean, this was awesome. I really appreciate you guys having me back and letting me share my heresy. No build. And it's been great. I'd say, you know, give enhance.dev a try. Shoot me, follow me on Mastodon. I'm trying to get off this Twitter habit. It's a hard one to kick, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's actually harder than that. I quit smoking and I can't get off Twitter. It's weird.
Oh, yeah. What about Threads? I was noticing, like, my Threads is popping. Anytime I post anything on Threads, it does super well. And I feel like everyone's like, oh, Threads is going to die out. I think it's finally past that initial curve. Obviously, it's Zuck at the helm there, but
yeah, Instagram really wants me to use it, but I'm holding back. I don't know. It's so ad heavy, or at least Insta is so ad heavy that I'm even kind of fading there, and the ads are not good.
Yeah,
which is kind of the problem for me. It's like if the ads were actually like, oh, maybe I want that plaid shirt, but no, that's. Weird things that I do not want. I'm avoiding that one too. I've been enjoying Mastodon for what it's worth, and weirdly LinkedIn is starting.
Weirdly LinkedIn
is place doing I go. Super well for me too.
Yeah,
I had made fun of LinkedIn for years, and now I post stuff, and it gets like legit engagement, like people actual nice comments, and people are having good conversations. So I was surprised.
Yeah, and it's civil because of the nature of it, I think.
Yeah, it's inherently civil. Yeah. I know we started making LinkedIn a priority for syntax to post our things to increase our footprint there. And it's like, I think at first people are like, why?
It's pretty good.
Why are you doing that? Well, let me tell you why. People are coming back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same thing where I was like, I don't know. But then, I'm finding it to be pretty okay. So,
yeah, absolutely. Do you have a sick pick for us today?
Oh my God. Yeah, I do. Actually, I'll just say Analog Pocket.
Oh, cool.
I got one and I've been replaying Minish Cap Zelda.
It's like a Game Retro. Boy?
It is all Game Boys and it plays the carts. So if you have old like Game Boy Advance or Game Boy Color or original Game Boy, but it also lets you load ROMs, so you can do that too.
Does it have emulators baked in, or are you...
You got to do a little install dance.
But, yeah, that's probably not allowed.
It's easy, and I have every Super Nintendo game. It's pretty fun. Totally recommend if you're into retro gaming at all. Remy Sharp sent me a Game Boy
I saw him do it a lot of them.
And I got into it and I was like, these are so fun. And then the algorithm did find me on this one. I don't remember where. And it was like, you might be interested in this. And I am interested in that. And I got one and it's super fun. Just like to pick up and play like old games that you played when you were a kid or perhaps prior to your birth, depending on your audience.
Yeah, my son, who's six, he has recently picked up his mom's old Game Boy. And now he is playing Pac-Man on the Game Boy. And he's like, this is incredible. Like, Game Boy's pretty dope, man.
They are. Yeah. So that's my sick pick.
That's a sick pick. I had no idea this was a thing. $219. That seems pretty reasonable, given that every game is free.
And your old carts still work. That's like the even cooler part. So like I dug up my carts and I've got all the old Zeldas and it's super fun.
Man.
And the screen on that thing it's great. Like stuff looks really good on it.
Nice.
Well, for Gen Z's listening, carts are cartridges, not vape products.
Yes, you cannot vape your Analog Pocket.
You cannot vape a Mario game, Gen Z. Please do not do that. Awesome. And shameless plugs, what would you like to plug?
Oh, well, please check out begin.com. Deploy an app using enhanced.dev and hit me up on one of those socials and tell me how it went.
Sick.
Also, try and integrate it with Sentry.io.
Yeah, look at you.
Oh, man, he's doing it for us. That's amazing.
Yeah. I think that's a great product. I think it's a necessary step for a production app. You got to have observability into systems to make them better. So people should check out Sentry. It's a good call.
Hell yeah. We feel that way too.
All right. Thanks again.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.